I'm Jordan Abel, Director of Public Programs at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to BINA, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of BINA, we partner with the Women's March of San Francisco to present the first in a series of community panels called We Marched, We Rallied, Now What? Today's panelists include Amina Jandali of Islamic Networks Group, Minda Berbeco of the Sierra Club, Gabriela Jimenez of Planned Parenthood, and Melanie Nathan of SF Pride. The moderator is Kanishka Karunarathna, legislative aide to San Francisco Supervisor Mark Farrell. And now join me on stage at the JCCSF as I introduce our guests. We're calling the series We Marched, We Rallied, Now What? And we'll be convening here every other month for conversations and opportunities to connect with organizations dedicated to promoting civil liberties, human rights, equality, and justice. Our next conversation is going to be on May 9th, and it will be on the topic of gender issues. So please come back. We'll be updating the website soon. But tonight, we are so thrilled to have representatives here from the Islamic Networks Group, the Sierra Club, Planned Parenthood, and the SF Pride Board. Our moderator this evening is legislative aide Kanishka Karunarathna. Yes. Who works for Supervisor Farrell at the San Francisco Board of Supervisors. So we're so proud to offer this series as part of our We Stand Connected initiative here at the JCC. We nurture a space for people to explore a more meaningful, healthy, and balanced life inspired by Jewish wisdom and values, and we affirm the Jewish values of friendship, inclusiveness, and welcoming strangers. And we believe very deeply in what we've built here as a community center and in the city of San Francisco and what we continue to build together. Proudly standing up, not standing by, every day. So it's my complete honor to introduce this panel, and Kanishka will take it away.
Hi, everyone. Welcome, and thank you again for being here. So I think I'm going to start with having everybody introduce yourself and give us a couple sentences about what your organization does.
Good evening. My name is Amina Jandali, and I'm a founding member and the content director for an organization called Islamic Networks Group. We are a nonprofit educational organization. Our office is in San Jose, but we have volunteers and staff throughout the Bay Area. And what we have been doing since 1993, so we're heading towards our 25th anniversary, is providing education about Islam and Muslims to a variety of venues, including middle schools, high schools, colleges, houses of worship, law enforcement agencies, rotary clubs, wherever people want to learn a little bit more about Islam, as well as issues relating to Muslims. They'll call on us and we'll go in and do a presentation. We also offer interfaith panels that feature the five major world faiths, as well as the three Abrahamic faiths and Jewish-Muslim panels to talk about contemporary issues that are of concern to other people. So, as you can imagine, we are extremely busy right now. I think it's the busiest semester in the last 24 years, so that's a good thing. Our resources are often stretched, but we've gotten some free marketing, let me put it that way.
Good evening, everybody. Thank you so much for being here. My name is Melanie Nathan, and I am vice president on the board of San Francisco Pride. Another hat I wear is I'm the executive director of the African Human Rights Coalition. The mission of the San Francisco Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, Transgender Pride Celebration Committee is to educate the world, commemorate our heritage, celebrate our culture, and liberate our people. We provide a platform at San Francisco Pride for everybody to come and celebrate, mourn, protest, depending on whatever's going on. Also, San Francisco Pride provides funding from the two-day celebration to hundreds of thousands of dollars to community partners. And you can become involved by participating in the parade and in the celebration, and also by becoming a member of Pride, looking at the website and seeing what you can do there. Really quickly, I was a attorney, an attorney during the apartheid era in South Africa. And my African Human Rights Coalition helps LGBTI refugees and asylum seekers on the continent of Africa with humanitarian assistance and advocacy, and also here in the United States and actually globally as well. And we need a lot of help. We had an awful time with the EO. We had people mid-air being turned around after years of vetting, and any help we can get is greatly appreciated. Thank you so much.
Good evening. My name is Gabriela Jimenez. I'm the Senior Public Affairs Officer for Planned Parenthood Northern California. I'm very happy to be here. So you may all know about Planned Parenthood, but specifically Planned Parenthood Northern California. We serve 100,000 patients in our 20 northern counties from San Francisco up to the Oregon border. And in addition to the 100,000 patients we serve in our medical facilities, we also serve 55,000 clients in our education outreach services. As you may know, that we offer reproductive healthcare services, including contraceptives, STD testing, abortion, cervical breast cancer screening, PrEP and PEP, as well as hormones for gender transition therapy. That's we're always trying to better cater our community. So we have been on the chopping block. We lived to fight another day, as you may all know, that, and we'll get into a little later, that the ACA was about to get repealed, and there was a nasty little line in there saying they wanted to defund Planned Parenthood. And before I go further, I want to kind of get rid of that misnomer about defunding, that Planned Parenthood does not get a blank check. We are like any other medical service provider and get reimbursed for services rendered for Medi-Cal recipients. So this was going to block people from accessing. Sometimes a lot of these people are, Planned Parenthood is their only source of health care throughout the year, from accessing Planned Parenthood, the health care provider of their choice. So, and at Planned Parenthood Northern California, that makes up about 85 to 90% of our clients are Medi-Cal recipients. So that would have had a huge, huge impact on those people who rely on us. And statewide, we have 115 health centers that serves 850,000 patients every year. So fun fact, that's actually about half of all Planned Parenthood patients throughout the entire country. So California very much has a lot to lose if Planned Parenthood funding were to go away. So we'll definitely have more to talk about how you all can get involved and what, you know, I would love to answer any questions you have, because I know it's very confusing and things are literally changing day by day. So thank you for having me.
Hi, I'm Minda. I'm the director of the local chapter of the Sierra Club, so the San Francisco Bay chapter. And I have to ask, are there any Sierra Club members in the room right here? Yeah. A couple panelists, too. I love being in San Francisco. This is why I'm here. This is great. Yeah. So those of you know what we do. We're an environmental organization. We've been around for about 100 years defending and protecting and also getting out into the environment. What's really unique about the Sierra Club, particularly the chapters, and our chapter is certainly very, very much of this case, is that rather than being a top-down organization, we are very much a grassroots organization. So we have 35,000 members in the Bay Area, and I like to say, as the director, I have 35,000 bosses. So instead of me being in charge of 35,000 members, they're in charge of me. And so they direct a lot of our environmental work, and they're actually the ones showing up to meetings, and with our support and staff support, really pushing a lot of our a lot of environmental initiatives forward. So how you can get involved is very easy. You just go to our website, find an issue that we work on that you're interested in, and you show up to a meeting. And that's all it takes. Well, you need to be a member, so do that too. But yeah, I mean, it's very simple. And then we definitely really encourage community involvement at the most grassroots level to really push environmental issues forward.
Great, thank you. So this is the first panel of the San Francisco Women's March, so we want to start it kind of broadly. Our goal tonight is for you all to leave with an understanding of what the local nonprofit community, whose work is very much threatened under the current administration, what they're all doing to fight for our progressive values. We want to know what's most important to you all as well, and what are the available resources, and more specifically, how we, the public, can channel our outrage and our fears into direct action to support the work that you all are doing. So just like the Women's March is broad and diverse in how people are drawn to feminism and liberalism, I think the variety of these organizations tonight reflect that. So you all, these organizations have been on the forefront of social change for a long time and sort of have fought these battles before. And you have infrastructure and tools at your disposal. So if maybe, Gabriella, you want to start by telling us what's the top legislative priority for Planned Parenthood, maybe NorCal or nationally?
Definitely. So first and foremost, our priority as Planned Parenthood is always to keep our doors open, no matter what. And that has been our tagline. It is something very true, no matter what type of both protest activity or funding challenges we might face, we are always here to have our doors open and serve our patients. So with that, that means maintaining our funding and even increasing our Medi-Cal reimbursement rates. So our budget and maintaining that, increasing our funding is always a priority. So I would say locally for Planned Parenthood Northern California and Planned Parents throughout the state, our legislative agenda this year is to come to our representatives in Sacramento and ask them to increase Medi-Cal reimbursement rates. During the recession era, they had cut back on those rates and have yet to restore them back to that level. And that is just completely unsustainable. It is not, we're not getting the funding we need for the services that we are providing. So on a local level, that is our big priority. And again, every year we set about having legislative priorities, what bills we're going to support, what we're going to co-sponsor and that type of thing. And this year, we're totally changing the game and really focusing hard on that. Because again, we need to make sure that people can continue to access care at Planned Parenthood. And then of course, nationally, we did not think we would be in this position 6 months ago, fighting for literally our lives. So nationally, making sure that any defunding bill never makes it onto the president's desk. It's a pretty scary thing because obviously conservatives and Republicans as a whole have the Senate, the House, and the White House. And soon enough, there'll be the Supreme Court. So it is very terrifying to see that this could really become a reality. So we do have a four-year war ahead of us. So there will be many opportunities for them to try to defund us.
So you've given us a very direct action that we can take locally, which is to contact our representatives in Sacramento and make the specific ask of increasing Medicare reimbursement rates.
Definitely.
So that's fantastic.
Yeah. And so to kind of go a little further on that, not only would I love for you to all talk to your representatives, and, you know, I would like to say that in San Francisco, they're completely supportive of us, but we do have our Capitol Day in Sacramento, May 15th. So we will have a bus of our supporters go to Sacramento, and they will be lobbying directly on this issue. So you get a chance to actually meet face-to-face with your representative and ask them, you know, tell them, this is why we need our doors to stay open, and this is why I need you to support this.
Great. So what's going to be the top priority for the Sierra Club now?
Well, I can speak for the local chapter, and because that's who I take care of here locally. One of the big priorities of our chapter, obviously, is around energy and certainly how energy relates to climate change. What's really unique about this area that we're living in right now is that we actually have the capacity to really shift our energy usage and where our energy is coming from in a way that folks maybe in other parts of the country don't. And so while we have this very nasty presidential administration right now that is very adverse to the concept of renewable energies and is very pro-dirty fossil fuels, we're in a unique position here to try to push a lot of these initiatives around renewable energies forward. And in doing so, really demonstrate to the rest of the country that not only can you do it, is it feasible, but you can do it when you have the presidential administration against you on this. And that's something that we're working very hard locally to push forward. And fortunately, I think we're going to make it happen. And I think that's going to be even more telling about how real this is, that it happens right now in this climate.
Great. Hey. So Melanie and Amina, I think your organizations do more education and advocacy work rather than legislative work. And I think that's a huge part of the conversation, too. We keep hearing about this social media effect and how we're all sort of in our own echo chambers hearing the same things that we already believe. And there's not really a lot of discourse anymore. So how can organizations like yours help to bridge that gap, you know, break down those walls that people have put up already? What do you think?
So beyond the ban obviously having its impact on the people that are involved, and my son-in-law happens to be Syrian. He doesn't have his green card yet. So obviously there was a lot of anxiety, especially with the first ban, just around what does it mean? Because nobody really seemed to know what it meant. And then the second ban made it a little bit clearer. So just not even talking about the impact on people directly impacted, because that's such a broad swath of people, students, visitors. The Canadians apparently aren't going to be visiting anymore. And so I want to just talk a little bit about Islamophobia generally, because what happens with these kind of policies is it not only impacts the direct people involved, but it kind of lays a foundation that it's okay to, you know, bash Muslims. It's okay to target mosques. There have been, since the beginning of the year, attacks on about 33. It was 32 when CNN printed it, and my parents' own mosque was targeted 2 days ago in Colorado. Somebody threw a Bible through the glass doors. Where my daughter lives in Tampa, her mosque was targeted. So it's feeling very close to me. So people just feel emboldened to do things that have happened in the past, but not at this level and not with such a wide swath where it's you know, all over the country, even in places where you would assume these kind of things don't happen. We've seen bullying of Muslim children that has already been quite high in the past few years also being a problem, not only children but also teachers. There's been a lot of complaints before and after the election of teachers being emboldened to say things like, you know, you're all going to get deported, calling a child a rag-headed Taliban. So there's just a sense that it's now totally okay to do and say things that have become quite normalized. This is not the first, you know, election cycle that did that. If you remember back to the Obama campaign, you know, what was the worst thing they said about him? That he was a closet Muslim, right? So it's all kind of building on the past, but I just think the level of vitriol and the openness, the lack of subtlety around it. So that's the bad news. The good news, as I said before, was just the outpouring of support, including the thousands of protesters who went to airports across the country. SFO, I was in Denver at the time. There was a big demonstration there, New York City. Really unprecedented. I mean, obviously the march set the precedent, but, you know, just out of the blue, people coming together and showing support that I think American Muslims haven't seen at that level. Here in the Bay Area, we've seen actions such as rings around the mosque, which have occurred before, but there was just one in Santa Clara, one of the largest mosques, and then reciprocating when some Jewish cemeteries were desecrated. A group of Muslims, including Linda Sarsour, one of the organizers of the Women's March nationally, started a fund to raise money, and they raised over $100,000. So you're having groups working together in interfaith, in all of these intersectional issues, that is quite unprecedented, I would say. And so for all of the bad news, there is some good news that people are being pushed to really understand that we're all in it together. I would say for Muslims, the greatest fear is that if, God forbid, and there's been a few articles written about this, there was a terror attack that was significant, we would go way beyond just the Muslim ban, and the registry might become a reality or worse. And so I think that is an issue that will come out of nowhere. People are not going to be able to prepare for that. So there's been discussions around sanctuary and what that looks like potentially for Muslims, but it's kind of hard to plan for something. So there's a little bit of fear. There's obviously women, particularly who are wearing this headscarf, who many of them have taken it off out of fear. Many of them are, you know, just changes in their lifestyle. But I think there's a very deep level of anxiety that is impacting the community, including just going to the mosque on Friday. I was attending the mosque myself a couple of weeks ago, and the person giving the sermon said, you know, it was a mosque like this in Quebec where people were praying. And so we have to be real that, you know, at any minute we could be attacked in the mosque. So far, most of the mosques have been vandalized or arson has occurred when nobody's there. But, you know, the worst case scenario would be where people are there. So there's good and bad news. Hopefully the good news will continue to push back against the bad news, but there is also a level of anxiety. And so in our organization, what we work to do is just to educate the public about Islam, because we believe that behind discrimination are attitudes that lead to the bias that ends in discrimination, and that without addressing those misconceptions about Islam and Muslims, it's very hard to change.
You're listening to We Marched, We Rallied, Now What? A community panel featuring Amina Jandali of Islamic Networks Group, Minda Berbeco of the Sierra Club, Gabriela Jimenez of Planned Parenthood, and Melanie Nathan of SF Pride. The moderator is Kanishka Karunarathna, legislative aide to San Francisco Supervisor Mark Farrell. On Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
And so, as I mentioned, we're very busy. We go out wherever people invite us, and beyond that, we have many resources on our website. We have answers to over 100 questions that have been asked by many audiences about Muslims, around terrorism, around women's issues, around Islamophobia. We have a special section on ISIS. So one of the things that people can do to push back is really just to educate themselves a little bit more, so that when they hear things, they can step in and say, you know, I've heard differently, and I don't think that's correct. It's very easy when people don't know to just let things slide. Another thing that a lot of people are recommending is that if you do see somebody bullying a Muslim, don't just stand there silently. And bullying could be just a microaggression, saying something that is not clearly, off, but that doesn't feel right. Stand up for that person, because it's very difficult for people to stand up for themselves. And we see that obviously in schools, but even with adults. And then, reach out to your Muslim neighbor. Reach out to your nearby mosque. We've had many incidences of neighboring churches coming over to mosques and, just trying to show their support. It's always good to let them know you're coming, because, they may just not be prepared. But it's actually been very good for the mosques. It's been forcing them to also interact, because you do have communities where they are recent immigrants and they haven't really had much interaction, and they're afraid. So just smiling, saying salam alaikum, little things will really reassure them that you're there to be supportive.
So could people come to your group to ask for representatives to come do education and outreach to neighborhood groups? I was mentioning backstage, the Marina Community Association had sort of a Meet a Muslim event where a Muslim woman came and just sort of took broad questions from anybody that wanted to learn more about Islam and what's appropriate, and just sort of dispel myths and rumors about the religion and the faith. But
yeah,
I think
absolutely.
It's a great way to build those bridges.
Yeah, there are many people doing this work, and there is a woman named Moina Shaikh. She does Meet a Muslim. She'll go to a coffee shop, she'll go to a library, and just take questions. We usually are invited to go, but yeah, absolutely. Wherever we're invited, we're happy to go. And now you're seeing a lot of Muslims doing this work as well. So there are
great
many opportunities.
Yeah. So Melanie, do you want to tell us about your advocacy work?
Yeah. I'd like to take this opportunity to speak in more broader terms about the LGBT community and what we face. I've lived here. I came as an immigrant from South Africa, and I've lived here for 30 years. And I came to this country with this vision of what it would be. And I knew there would be a fight as a lesbian. I knew that there would be a fight to get our rights or to get our rights endorsed, to be able to live to be in a way that made me equal. And we fought, and things happened. And in the last administration, we did a lot of great stuff, and we had a lot of help. To see that, the vision of that, and the actuality of that come crashing down, or potentially come crashing down, I cannot even begin to explain what that means to me personally, to my children. I have a daughter sitting here, and to my community. It's terrifying. And so my hope would be that everybody would find a way to be differently aware, to find a way to think beyond just same-sex marriage, but to look at everything that impacts our lives. We're impacted as immigrants. We're impacted as refugees and asylum seekers by what's going on now. My big fear is the First Amendment Defense Act, which was introduced into the last Congress. That is a piece of legislation that could possibly pass in a Republican-held House of Representatives, Senate, and presidency, especially with the likes of Bannon scratching Donald Trump's back and Jeff Sessions in the DOJ and Neil Gorsuch, the Supreme Court Justice. I mean, this is really terrifying stuff for us. So the awareness, you know, I don't know if any of you even know about the First Amendment Defense Act, but what I encourage you to go home and read about it, because if that does come down, we've all got to get moving. And to that end, we are looking at a myriad of organizations, not just my organization, but a lot of us coming together and doing the work we've been doing, but in a bigger way, and reaching out to people to spread the awareness through social media, etc. This is not stuff we can turn our back on and pretend is not happening, and we need to be ready for it. So that particular piece of legislation will turn it hides, it's an insidious name, and it hides behind so-called religious freedoms to take away civil rights. That's what it pretty much does. And this is what we've been looking at in various states. A lot of these things have been defeated. I don't want to go into specifics. This is stuff you can Google and look up quite easily. So we have a fight on so many fronts. I have a silly little blog, and on my silly little blog, I wrote about Heather Wilson. Heather Wilson is a nominee to the Air Force. She's done stuff when she was a representative in Congress, and everything that was equality related, she voted against. Now, this is who's sitting in that position. Then you've got Severino. I forget his first name. He's a Secretary of Health and Human Services. You've got Ben Carson. You've got Neil Gorsuch being in the process of confirmation right now. We all need to be speaking out. I mean, these people impact us in every aspect of our intersectionality, in every aspect of our LGBTQI and our immigration status, and our status as women, and our status as people living and breathing in this environment. This is a guy that's going to make those ultimate decisions. He supposedly balances out the court, but, you know, because we had, what was his name, Scalia there, you know. But what if Bader Ginsburg drops out tomorrow, God forbid, you know? I mean, please, God, hold on to her, you know? So this is very, very serious time. So, and the one thing I just want to mention, I don't want to only speak to my organization. I think it's really important to speak to all the LGBT organizations out there. There's NCLR here in San Francisco doing a fantastic job. There's Lambda Legal. We're all putting in doing our usual day's job, which counteracts a lot of this or seeks to, and we're also putting in amicus briefs and stuff like that when we need to. My African Human Rights Coalition, we're going to be putting in an amicus brief, which we're working on right now in the we'll be getting ready in case, depending on what comes down with the current TRO against the executive orders where Trump was trying to stop or suspend the U.S. refugee program. As LGBT people, we are hugely impacted by the Muslim ban on travel. As LGBT people, and hardly spoken about in media, which was so surprising to me, the media seemed to forget about the 120-day suspension on the entire U.S. refugee program. That I was working with, one example, a transgender woman who was literally on her way to the airport. This woman had been through, I don't even want to describe what she'd been through, but she was resettled by UNHCR. The amount of vetting that she had gone through to be able to resettle in the United States was just tremendous. She's on her way to the airport, and she gets turned back. What that meant to that one person was this. The place she was staying as a safe shelter was gone. It was not there anymore. Nobody had given her 1 cent to have on her as money. This is a person without anything to her name. So she's coming, being sent back, And you've got IOM and Hyas and everybody scrambling to try and find a place for her to stay, to try and find how she's going to eat for the next week and how to keep her safe from everybody else around her, because her situation is that marginalized as an LGBT person in a host country that doesn't even want her there. So, you know, I mean, I'm just touching – this is a tip of the iceberg of how this impacts so many people. So my hope is that all of you will really take a look beyond what you see right in front of you and really take interest in looking at the nuances of who's being appointed to what, speaking to your representatives, making a lot of noise and making sure that just like, you know, the noise that was made for the ACA and something clicked and worked there, let's hope we can do that for the LGBT community and the intersecting communities who we're involved in. And another piece of work that we need to keep our eye on, and I've had a direct encounter with him, and trust me, he's a racist, he's an Islamophobe, he's a bigot, and in short-term English, he's a and his name is Jeff Sessions. Thank you.
So it sounds like Jeff Sessions and Gorsuch are the two biggest threats that you see.
Absolutely. Okay. So not to mention the man who's going to sign those pieces of legislation and who started all this nonsense.
So the refugee resettlement program ban that you brought up, it's that's sort of one story of one individual, but it's also been brought up that it really is not a benefit to national security because it prevents our military from engaging with translators and sort of handlers when they're in these countries. So it's a much broader program, and I think something we should all be more involved in, because you're right, the media is not talking about that very much. Something else I want to talk about, it seems like under this administration, we're not going to be able to really push our legislative ideas forward. We're just trying to hold ground. And just in the past 6 months, it's like we've lost ground. So something like the Muslim ban just sort of came at us out of nowhere. Can you talk about at all any kind of structures that were in place to spur that very quick reaction that we saw, including like with legal services?
I mean, I think because he'd been talking about it throughout the campaign, it wasn't a total surprise. It was just a surprise how quickly. I mean, that first week there was like 10 executive orders. But it seemed a bit spontaneous in terms of the protests. And those were very impressive in terms of the numbers that they pulled. So I don't know what it was that really resonated with people in a way that some of the other executive orders didn't, maybe because it is so tangible. Like, you know, there were people arriving at the airport and being turned back or being held for questioning for a long period of time. We've had Ibtihaj Muhammad, who was an Olympian, held for questioning for 2-3 hours. The son of Muhammad Ali has been held in question. So it's impacting people in a large swath. And in terms of the amicus briefs or the other work that's been doing, I'm sure groups like Muslim Advocate or CARE kind of expected it, but I'm sure they had to. I mean, I know these people aren't sleeping. They're not. They're like putting in 18-hour days. So I don't think anyone was prepared for how quickly it was turned around. And I think there was like 2 weeks where they kept saying the next ban is coming out. And that one was delayed. So I think that gave people a little more time. But again, not knowing exactly how it was going to look, how different it would be from the first ban, you know, that might have made it a little more challenging. And so, yeah, there's a little bit of everyone's just like nobody. You know, I joke on Facebook that every hour, well, it's slowed down a little bit. There was a point where every hour it was breaking news. Breaking news no longer means breaking news because it's every hour.
Every morning, like what fresh hell will we wake up to?
Yeah, exactly. I don't even watch TV anymore. It's just too much. Yeah.
Go ahead, get back.
So, you're exactly right. Unfortunately, we are at Planned Parenthood having to hold our ground as opposed to pushing forward progressive legislation. I remember looking through some old emails and just remembering that dream that was of repealing the Hyde Amendment, which was it's a ban on using federal funds for abortion. So this is obviously targeting our most vulnerable populations. So I remember over the summer, and we're gearing up working on our campaign to have Hillary be our next president. And we were like, the first thing she's going to do is repeal Hyde. And then, you know, then the world, like then, you know, of course. And so obviously the day after the election, we woke up to a new world and a new scenario. And I was in a kind of a rough state, but my phone was ringing off the hook with people wanting to help. And I was completely astounded. I did not expect that. I was in no place to be answering the calls, but, you know, I was just amazed to hear that outpouring of support. And so, yes, you're right. You know, we are have been gearing up since that day on this is the timeline. This is what we see happening. This is what they've said. And, you know, this is not new, right? We've been fighting this battle for a very long time. So it did have to become a lot more real, but we have been fighting and will continue to fight since the day after the election.
Yeah, I think one benefit to their craziness is that they're very literal in what they say, so we know what they want to do. Yeah. They're not hiding anything. So we brought up the Affordable Care Act. We learned a lot during that process of upholding that, and one image that keeps sticking out to me is the pictures we kept seeing of a bunch of old white men at a table making a decision about women's health care, not just abortion reproductive rights, but whether maternity care should be covered under health care. So I think this is something we could all talk about. What can we be doing to get more women a seat at that table? So today, Hillary gave a speech, and I think her last words were, resist, insist, persist, and enlist.
Yes.
So more of us need to be running for office.
Definitely. I mean, at Planned Parenthood, we have a pretty robust legislative and electoral side to our work. So this last year, we invested more than we ever had in our electoral field work. And I was very lucky to be a part of that movement. And while we obviously did not get the major win we were looking for, we did get a lot of local wins. So 85% of our endorsed candidates in Planned Parenthood Northern California region won. And these are obviously people that are very supportive of our issues and they want to push our issues forward. But also we did a lot of work in Nevada. I'm sure a lot of you all did some door knocking in Nevada. And we were able to bring home a win for Senator Catherine Cortez Masto. So I would love to, you know, give you that action item when 2018 does come around. We will be looking for volunteers to do phone banking and canvassing and, you know, would love for you all to help knock on those doors and make those calls for people who are supportive of Planned Parenthood and progressive issues.
I think that we can start taking some questions now.
I'm just wondering, you know, I kind of get sick of calling Kamala Harris's office and Dianne Feinstein. So I'm wondering, you know, like as we're resisting, obviously we're writing the postcards. But how else? I mean, I've been hung up on by, you know, Lamar Alexander and, you know, a variety of places where I've lived. I decided to call the states that I've lived in from time to time. And just how can we affect the change? Because, you know, we say we live in these echo chambers, or people tell me, oh, you live in a bubble. I feel like they live in a bubble. We live in the real world in California and New York and some of these other places, and they're living in a bubble in the Rust Belt or the Southeast, you know, and I'm just wondering if people are strategizing, how do we affect the way people think there?
You know, I love that question. Don't ever be sick of reaching out to Senator Feinstein and Senator Harris. I'll be honest, I'm a little bit disappointed in Senator Harris because I've left information at her office that I would have expected a call back on, and I never got the call back. And it was inside information that I thought would be particularly useful. Senator Feinstein has done a tremendous amount of assisting to me and my organization personally. And so I think when people from the outside are bringing in a sentiment, I think it really trickles down to what they will still do that they might not otherwise have done. And it's not always on the surface. Senator Feinstein introduced a private bill into Congress for a client of mine back in 2009. And I know that it was a lot to do with the sentiment that was being expressed. So there is that. I like tweeting. I don't know if it's in the atmosphere or the milieu or what, but I even tweeted the airport authority in Frankfurt at 2 o'clock in the morning to say there's a refugee standing at gate 57 who doesn't have money and she's hungry and she doesn't have water. And they tweeted me back and they took her food. Twitter is quite fantastic.
And I would agree, absolutely.
Yeah, and I think that if you look for nuances and you look for ways in to other people in other states and you find ways to connect and you find ways to talk and start a little bit of a something like that, you know, I think that that is very, very helpful to getting through to people across state lines. My big fear is that they're all going to come to California when Jerry Brown's doing the right thing and they voted for the bloke that's doing the wrong thing. You know, I don't know.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's program is We Marched, We Rallied, Now What? A community panel featuring Amina Jandali of Islamic Networks Group, Minda Berbeko of the Sierra Club, Gabriela Jimenez of Planned Parenthood, and Melanie Nathan of SF Pride. The moderator is Kanishka Karunarathna, legislative aide to San Francisco Supervisor Mark Farrell. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
If it's your own representative, I think you have to sort of force that conversation because they are accountable to you. And if they're not listening to you, there have to be like-minded folks that also voted for that person or live in that district. And I think it's about organizing those people to hold them accountable. Resistance recess was a big thing when everybody came back for recess. And Twitter was used heavily to force them to have town halls and hold them accountable. So I do think that Twitter is a great tool, and constant pressure, I think, is the way to go.
Another question?
I wanted to interject real quick and just kind of echo some of what you were saying and answer your question also. I think what would resonate with all of us is sharing your story and how powerful that is with your friends and family. So depending on whatever issue is most important to you, whether it's reproductive health care, LGBTQ issues, environment, whichever, if you have that uncle that you hate having conversation with at Thanksgiving, like have that conversation. Say, look, this has impacted me directly, or, you know, my partner is, you know, impacted by this directly. This is why it's important to me, and this is why I want you to understand that, like, defunding Planned Parenthood is real and will have a mass effect, not just this arbitrary person that you've never seen.
That's right.
It affects me. So having those real conversations with your friends and family is incredibly important, and really tapping into your personal story. I think that's universal with any issue.
That's right.
Can I also add that, I mean, I think our impetus after the election was, you know, if you voted for Trump, I'm taking you off Facebook. If you're a family member, we're not talking. I mean, there's families that have been split apart over this whole thing. And so I think we have to realize that we are a very polarized nation, and that we are each in our, you know, there's multiple Americas, and certainly the West Coast had its own environment, and that it is important to continue having those conversations, even though they are difficult, there are going to be disagreements. But if we just cut everyone off and don't talk to them, how are we ever going to influence them? And that's the hardest job, actually.
Yeah.
Thank you. Another question over here.
I was really interested to hear that you had trouble with Kamala Harris. You know, I've felt like she's been mostly doing stuff that I want. So I haven't been bugging her as much as I could. So it's really important for me and others to know that someone that we are expecting to do the right thing aren't. You know, for the most part, I feel like my representatives in California are doing the right thing. So how can we get better plugged in to know in advance when something like that needs our help?
You know, that's a really good question, too. I would give leeway to the fact that she's new in the Senate, definitely. And it's not to say that I don't totally appreciate her stand in and a lot of the stuff that I've seen come from her. So I hope I didn't overstate that. But I do hold my representatives locally, notwithstanding their sentiments, to a very high standard. And that's why I feel like it's important to speak out about it. But I think really looking at what the issues are beyond what's just here, digging deeper, helps you get a better picture of what's going on in the periphery. And I think you don't have to always follow someone else's lead. You know, there are things there that you can find and decide that this is something you want to talk about. So you can find this stuff long before it happens. I'd hope today that just by mentioning the First Amendment Defense Act, that so many, even in my own LGBTI community, many people don't even know what that is. You know, so if you know about this stuff and you just keep reading and looking at what's out there beyond what you're seeing in the immediate media, really will help prepare you ahead of the game, and still holding everybody deeply accountable beyond the normal course of what's simply out there. I hope that makes sense.
I think I could just add a little bit more to that as well. As you asked the question, how can you plug in? And I'm sure everyone here feels like they're drinking from a fire hose, because every day the news is just, oh my gosh, I have to limit checking the news to like 9, noon, and 5, because otherwise I would just read it all day. I think that's the benefit of the organizations you see represented here. I know my organization, the Sierra Club, is, you know, they're paid staff whose job it is to pay attention to this stuff and alert you when this comes out and tell you exactly who you should get in touch with, whether it's your local representative or somebody on the federal level. And so really plugging in, figuring out those organizations that you really align yourself with, plugging into them and relying on them to really do their job. And that's what we're here for.
Can you say definitively the best way to contact, like, a congressperson? Is it by phone? I've heard that they track phone calls, and at the end of the day, the staffers report the top three topics that people called in on, or are postcards more effective, or are the phone calls more effective, or the local or the government level? Thank you.
I think phone calls are the most effective, just because staffers are constantly working, and if they have to keep answering the phone, it gets their attention. Mm-hmm. And we do keep, I mean, I work at the local level, and we do keep tallies of what we're getting calls on and what side of the issue people are at. And like somebody mentioned here, personal stories are the most resonant. Some people just call and like, oh, I hate this and I want you to vote against it. Okay, like that's a tally. But if you give me a personal story, it'll stick with me and I'll convey it to my boss. So I think that really is the best way.
Hi, thank you everybody for being here. Two questions. One, I feel like two things are not being named about why we're here, which is the system of patriarchy and white supremacy. It could be anybody at the top, and it literally could be anybody. So even if he does get impeached, it's going to be somebody else who comes in. So how are we treating the source of this issue, which is patriarchy and white supremacy, in this moment where women are rising like I've never seen? How are we naming the power of women in this moment? That's my first question. My second question is, who are the leaders that you're looking to right now that we can also follow and build from?
Just real quickly, because I'd love to hear everyone else's response, but I think part of empowering women is by ensuring their autonomy of their bodies. It was a women's march in D.C., and I was watching live stream, and I think it was Gloria Steinem saying, women cannot control their lives from the skin out unless they can control it from the skin in. And that's really stuck with me. And I feel like that's an important part of our work at Planned Parenthood, by allowing people their freedoms and their choice to live their life how they choose. So that's just like one way that we are trying to continue that.
Just how are we doing it differently than how we've ever done it before, with this opportunity of women stepping forward in ways they never have, I guess is more specifically what I'm trying to get at.
I think that the Women's March was a phenomenon, and I think it needs to be expanded upon, and I don't think we should rest on our laurels and let that stop. I want my daughter to see that, and I think everything lies in the future. everything lies in our daughters. I look at my daughters and I look at how differently they treat life and how differently life treats them than the way I was treated. And I think that the way I was treated might still be happening in other places. So I think it's really important to really home in and target our young people and do much more mentoring and much more going to the schools and speaking and doing programming around that kind of thing, finding ways to teach young women leadership. I remember my late mother walking into the bank when I was 14 years old and screaming at the bank manager because he insisted that she bring my dad in to sign for her safety deposit box. That stood out for me, you know. I mean, my mother was fuming. How dare you want my husband's signature for something I want to hide away from him? You know, I mean, and, you know, this is the kind of thing that we need to model to our kids. Who, you asked the question, who are we looking up to? I'm looking up to Kamala Harris. She's young, and I like her politics somewhat, as much as I can like politics. And I think that there are people that we don't even know about. I think we need to look at people in the grassroots arena that tend to be ignored because they don't have big money behind them. So I'm hoping that Women's March can find a way to create forums to bring young people to the fore out as politicians who will not have to rely on big money because big money's not hearing what they want to hear. And I think with the power that I've seen, I think the people movement ought to be much more strong than the money movement. That is my hope.
I just wanted to add to that. So after the march, I was in D.C. for the march, and then we started a group afterward, which has grown exponentially. And we focus on our down-ballot races, 50-state strategy for women and progressives running, whether it's for dog catcher or state boards of education, whatever that is, and everything in between. You have to get out and vote for those down-ballot races. They are vital, and they are the training ground for all of the women and progressives coming up. They become the president. They, you know, well, not this president. He has no experience. But generally, I mean, they become our representatives and our senators. They start somewhere, and it's in those down-ballot races. They are vital. Not only that, but there's a census in 2021, and we have to change those state house seats,
the gerrymandering,
across the country before 2021, so that our people have a chance to redraw those district lines. It's vital. Those 2018 races are everything. Get out and march. And oh, one other thing, we get this question all the time, like, what do we do? What do we do? And we have, I always say this, three prongs. Number one, continue to protest because it works. It's why ACA got voted down.
That's
because
right.
People turned out and threatened their representatives and they were afraid to vote for it. Number two, we say, whether you give $10 a year or $10,000 a year in donations to those people like the ones on the stage who are in the crosshairs of this agenda, double down. Give twice as much to twice as many groups. It's more important now. If not now, when? Just dig deep and ask everybody, if not now, when? And number three, like I said before, those down ballot races are vital.
Yeah, if I could just add on that, I think that answers sort of both of the things that you guys are talking about. The grassroots is more important now than ever, and the local races and the local issues, because not only is it the training ground, right, and it's affecting you here locally, but it's an opportunity for you to demonstrate to other parts of the country how to do it well, how to do it right, how to make it work. And I think that that's maybe not different from what we've done historically, because I think these are things that we know how to do, but it's just more important that we focus on this now.
May I say one other thing? So I was a law student during the apartheid era and practiced law in South Africa during the apartheid era. Now, I know that you had a majority that was being trampled upon by the minority. So that's kind of a little bit different to here. But there is people bring their power when they protest, more so when they boycott. What we should be doing here let me give you an example. When they were having that woman's walking out of work thing, how many people, I do a lot on social media, how many people say, well, I can't afford to do it because I'm going to get fired from my job and I'm poor. And Well, if you have a lot to lose, you've got to take that risk even more. There's even more reason to take that risk. But here's the thing. Hold that boss, who must probably that white guy sitting there who's been there for 30 years and you haven't quite made it there, but you're depending on him for your salary and you're still poor. Hold him accountable. Get the 30 people in your office to go to him and say, hey, we want you behind us on this. We're all not going to come to work on Monday, and why don't you do something for your company and come out and say, hey, we support our women. So bandying together, showing the power of the people, protest that you're not afraid of. Do you know in South Africa it was those boycotts and those walkouts that where children couldn't go home and eat that night? It was that that brought the apartheid government to their knees. But people were willing to take that risk because they felt it that badly.
So that question that you had about how we can sort of capture this energy into more action to change the power structure, I think this was something we were trying to talk about, is how do we engage with people across the aisle, because it really is about changing those minds and getting through to them on a personal level. And I think, Gabriela and Minda, you talked about sharing your personal stories with people that you think might not see it your way, but when you personalize it to what has affected you, I mean, it's hard for somebody not to see, like, you are an individual and it's been affecting you in this particular way. So that's one thing. And I think the down ballot race issue is a huge one. And not just the names on the ballot. Like, if you want to really get into it, San Francisco has, I can't even tell you how many commissions and task force and advisory boards that nobody is engaged on advocating for people that are applying for those positions. So that's one great way to follow who's being put up for these seats, because those are the training grounds for your future leaders.
Yeah, and I think for women also, just on, you know, I want to say on our side, just women understanding each other and our own experiences, the intersectionality is super important. And if you look at congress.gov, you can see which Congress people are on which committees. And sometimes I will call committee members for a particular, you know, if there's a bill that's up, because I, you know, like maybe I'll call someone in Tennessee or, you know, another state that I think would be more effective than just calling someone California.
I was just going to also say that one of the things Kamala Harris's office did tell me to do was to call Daryl Issa's office. And so I did put that on my Facebook and call and got a lot of, there are Republican representatives here in California that we should all be calling.
Thank you. Okay, so I think we're gonna wrap up, but hopefully we've conveyed to you that there are organizations doing the work, and if you feel overwhelmed by what to do, pick one issue, maybe, whether it's Sierra Club or Planned Parenthood or Pride or the Islamic Network, that you care about, and get on their mailing list and find out how you can get engaged with them. So hopefully this conversation has been helpful to you all to navigate the options. And the most important thing is to take action. So maybe we'll see you phone banking this weekend. Thank you. Thank you.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's program was the first in a series of community panels called We Marched, We Rallied, Now What?, presented in partnership with the Women's March of San Francisco. The panelists were Amina Jandali of Islamic Networks Group, Minda Berbeco of the Sierra Club, Gabriela Jimenez of Planned Parenthood, and Melanie Nathan of SF Pride. The moderator was Kanishka Karuna Ruthna, legislative aide to San Francisco Supervisor Mark Farrell. The recording engineers of the JCCSF are Ben Bernardi, Brandon Battaglia, Dan Folds, Alex Espalay, Maya Finley, and Jake Kukowski. David Kwan edits and produces this program, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rasha Neem Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Jordan Abel. Thanks for listening.